host of facts, any of which independently can lead to the relief under this complaint. And I think that the district court failed to take into consideration the facts that were being pled as opposed to an underlying theme that these are disgruntled investors who are seeking their money back from somebody who is not responsible for the loss. So let me talk about that in particular. It's alleged, and I think that facts regarding what Pearson admitted to later on about the investments show that Pearson was a disqualified individual from the inception of these investments, and that the defendants, and all of them, knew this not only because of their intimate involvement, remember he was a franchisee of the parent company, but also because they did their own internal investigation regarding the investments that he was going to put this to, and they transferred the money directly to his account. It's a specific violation. So the question becomes, and I'm going to concede for the purposes of this particular argument, this portion of the argument, that they're not even fiduciaries. But we have a contractual relationship that has a feature of trust and confidence, and I think we certainly have that here because these are custodians. I mean, I think you use the term custodian, it's used loosely in this context, but if you use the term custodial, position in any other context, it comes with a element of trust and care. And the trust and care arising from this contractual situation should have led the defendants to disclose to these parties that they are investing with a disqualified investor. And they didn't do that. And I think that the common law regarding the concealment of fact is compelling that they should have made that disclosure at the inception. And if, in fact, the court agrees with that, that would make potentially them liable for the entire investment itself.
Yeah, so your time is going quickly, and I think there's a lot of detail in here. I would really like you to get to some questions about statute of limitations, and I'd also like you to get to a question as to whether Ms. White is elderly.
Okay, well, she is elderly by the pleading. It alleges that she's elderly. He also does
this really as of the time, but from the pleading, if that's correct,
well,
she's not elderly as of the time that the fraud was perpetrated.
Well, but Your Honor, this is why I was going to get to this argument independently, but let's just take it now with respect to the statute of limitations. You recall in the pleading that she has a phone call with the actual defendant, Mr. Brahma, who's an executive at this company, and he tells her, hey, you know what, there's nothing we can do about the reporting of your asset at a value other than zero. Something we can do about it, we rely on what Mr. Pearson tells us. Well, that's absolutely in contravention of what the IRS code says, is that the custodian has the duty to go out and find the valuation of the asset. And in fact, during that conversation, which I believe
was what year was that conversation?
I believe that was 2013. And it was shortly before the pleading was filed, though, if my memory serves me correctly, but it was certainly within 3 years of the pleading being filed, nevertheless. And at that point in time, they continue from that point forward on an asset that they know is valued at zero.
And how old was she in 2013?
Your Honor, I don't have the specific answer to that question. In the pleading, I
know that the complaint was filed.
The complaint was filed in March of 2013. And
she was done with 65.
Your Honor, it's really not an issue. I was really focused on the concealment aspect of the complaint. And that's where I think that in the broadest sense of what the test underneath was, provides a basis for the monetary relief and a claim upon which relief can be granted. And the fact that they continued to send out statements, not only in her case, but also in Ms. Moran's case, it's a continuing tort. And it's a continuing tort that is based materially on a breach of the duties under the IRS code, but also the mere fact that Brahma is telling her it's nothing we can do about this is a misrepresentation. It's a concealment effect, and it's something that there's two aspects of this in terms of the way I see it. There's two aspects of what this concealment gives rise to. Number one, it gives rise to a continuing obligation on the part of Entrust to do something. And number two, it gives them the right to collect fees.
And Justin, I really need you to come down the ladder of abstraction. You're dealing at a very, very high level, and I need you to be very, very specific. So we have two clients here before us. limitations.
That is correct. And in mid-2011, he is gone after receiving it. This is paragraph 183 on page 34 of the complaint, page 126 of the excerpt. That in mid-2011, after receiving conflicting information from Mid-South, which is the franchisee, and Intros, he calls up and said, number one, finds out that Pearson is no longer with the company.
These are wonderful arguments. This is not the basis on which the district court dismissed your complaint. The district court said that he knew as of 2008. The question is not how late did he know. The question is how early did he know.
No, Your Honor, that's a different issue. With due respect, that's a different issue. That's an issue that goes to whether Intrust can be tagged with the entire investment. The continuing fraud on the part of Intrust is that after they know that the investment is worth zero, they continue to send out statements that show the value at a different market value, and they continue to collect fees for the management of an account that is all but dead. And the only reason it's kept alive is for them to charge our clients money. And that's the basis for the concealment claim. It's two prongs, Your Honor. The first prong goes to attacking the whole investment itself. The second prong, and it's alleged in the complaint, is a separate form of injury, which is a continuing obligation on their part to accurately report the value. And once they reported the actual value, if they had done it in a timely fashion, the contract would have been terminated, and their ability to collect fees would have ceased. But instead, they kept the ruse going solely for the purpose of collecting the fees, and that's the basis for that portion of the damage claim. So even if you reject the portion of the claim that relates to the investment liability, you still have the portion of the claim that relates to their ongoing duty to report the accurate value, and the fact that they did not do so, and they continue to not do so, it's a continuing tort. They continue to conceal it. You know, at least with 3 years of the filing of the complaint, you might have a statute of limitations in a situation that bars you from going back beyond 3 years to collect damages for what occurred before that 3-year period. But clearly, within 3 years of the filing of the complaint and forward, in fact, you have a company that is not only sending out false information and specifically charging a fee based upon it. And I notice my time is running out. I just want to touch on one other issue. And this is kind of a secondary issue, but with respect to whether they are fiduciaries, they clearly disavow that in every written document and, you know, multiple times in multiple ways. So there's no doubt that they are aware of what the ramifications of being a fiduciary are.
Well, I'm not so aware, because if I read Hobbs v. Bateman Eichler in the California Appellate 1985, it says, even in the case of a special relationship, once a plaintiff becomes aware of facts which would make a reasonably prudent plaintiff person suspicious, the duty to investigate arises, and the plaintiff may then be charged with knowledge of the facts which he could have discovered by such an investigation. And so in that case, even with the special relationship, he has 3 years from the time a reasonably prudent person would have been suspicious, even with the relationship. So if I look at that, then I'm back to where Judge Bybee is again.
But, Your Honor, with all due respect, I don't think that applies to this continuing obligation to send out the fair market value. Because remember, Grama tells White specifically, I can't do anything about that. We rely on the evaluations that are given by Pearson.
But just a minute. If a note is in default due to non-payment, he's called to find out what the deal is all about that. If he's received no financial information about the paying entity, and he calls and finds out nothing about it, if the investment statements don't accurately reflect what's in the account, and all of this is happening, it's hard for me to say that a reasonably prudent person isn't suspicious.
Your Honor, but that's not the point. The point is,
what is the point? That's what the case says.
Clearly,
when this reasonably prudent person is suspicious, the duty arises.
That goes to the issue of the underlying investment, not their continued duty to provide an accurate valuation.
In your mind, this is a continuing tort. So even if you're suspicious, even if you ought to do something about it, the very fact that it continues makes it such that you get 3 years in any event. that's your argument?
No, Your Honor. First off, I think your statement has a false premise.
I don't think it's a false premise, given what I know or I knew and what happened. I mean, his promissory note was even unsigned, and the due date was left blank, and then he doesn't get the investment statements. In my book, special relationship or not, a reasonable and prudent person has to do something about it. The only way you're going to convince me is to say the three-year statute, because it continues, he gets another 3 years every time. And I want to know what case says that.
Well, Your Honor, there's plenty of cases. I don't have them right here, but California law.
You don't have them in your brief either.
Well, look, I mean, everybody's familiar with the concept of a continuing tort.
I understand that, but you've got to plead it. I didn't see it in your brief any place.
Your Honor, I think we've pled a continuous tort because we've pled that in 2011 and as to Moran and in 2013 as to White. They're in contact with Antitrust, and they're telling them we can't do anything about the valuation. Your account statements are going to remain the same, and you're going to continue to be charged. They have a credit card to charge it. So that's the conduct that is the continuing tort. Now, you can argue about notice, fiduciary duties, concealment, and everything else as to the original investment. But if you have individuals and a company that knowingly is sending out false statements upon which they are then extracting a fee, that's a continuing tort. And when both clients contact them and they say, I can't do anything about it, we rely on Pearson to give us the evaluations, which they know is bogus, and they know Pearson's upside down. I mean, Pearson admits that he absconded with the money. He says he's going to sell off assets to pay back the debtors. So the situation here is, can you knowingly send out statements knowing that they're false and charge a fee upon it? That's the issue.
Thank you. We'll hear from the other side.
May it please the court, my name is Mark Turner, and I'm here as counsel for Finance Antitrust Group, Antitrust Administration, Inc., and Hugh Roma. Your Honors, when I step back from this case, it has always been one of confusion as one tried to discern what's really at issue in the pleadings. This comes with a backdrop, as I'm sure Your Honors know, that this is the last of a trio of punitive class action cases brought against my clients. Submitted to the court that motions to dismiss were granted in the Northern District of California in the present case and affirmed by the Ninth Circuit just last year. There was a First Amendment complaint filed there and then motion denied to file a second complaint. But my point is that there have been nine pleadings that I count over three cases. This is the last of the cases, or the last of the pleadings, that do not state a claim against my clients. And for counsel to come today and invent a new theory, not argued or pled nonetheless in this case, is
inappropriate. And the new theory that's heard today is what?
Continuing fraud to somehow beat a clear statute of limitations defense.
I thought it was always the claim that they kept issuing statements that showed a value that wasn't there and that they were going to keep using
it. True, they did assert that the statements were essentially unchanged. And, Your Honor, I'll submit that both the contracts, the bidirectional letter, and the account agreement in this case do not impose any duty on my clients, the entities who are record keepers and administrators, purely relying only on the information that they receive. They have no duty whatsoever to go out and discern what the real information or value actually is. And in fact, Your Honor, we cited this in our brief. There's an SEC guidance issued in 2011 an IRA custodian is responsible only for holding and administering assets. They are not responsible for evaluating the quality or legitimacy of an investment. Most custodial agreements, self-directed custodial agreements and administration agreements, they explicitly state that the custodian and administrator have no responsibility for investment performance. And to get to your point, Your Honor, may I quote here from page 2 of this guidance? It said, the SEC says, quote, as a result, self-directed IRA custodians often list the value of the investment as the original purchase price, comma, the original purchase plus returns reported by the promoter, or a price provided by the promoter. Then in italics, it goes on to say, investors should be aware that none of these valuations necessarily reflect the price at which the investment could be sold, if at all. There is no question that it is unfortunate that these...
But they have claimed that the investment was worth nothing at that point, and your clients knew it. And nevertheless, instead of closing out accounts, they kept charging fees for non-existing assets.
Well, Your Honor, the claims were time-barred at the outset. And, Your Honor, the contracts here, as well as the case law that we've cited, make clear that there is no duty for my clients to change the account statements or go out and make an independent inquiry. They rely only on the specific information that they received. It could be from the promoter, it could be from the investor themselves.
Your view is that even if your clients knew their assets was basically zero balance in the account, they could just continue charging fees for that mistake.
Under the structure of this arrangement, under the contracts here, under the norms in the industry, as the SEC has overviewed over the years, Your Honor, the answer is that our client had no duty to change those statements independently.
They could charge fees on them even though they knew there was no value or no assets in there.
They could. If there was a record and there was none, that the account holder wrote to them and said, change the value on my accounts, then that might be a different thing. But the underlying cause of this investment loss was the fraud promoter who has already sustained a default judgment in this case, and the damage was done shortly after the investments were made in the late 2000s. If I may, Your Honors, I do wish to apologize for something and make a request. In the reply brief of the appellants, they make much of a SEC cease and desist order and put forth many pages of a chart showing how their allegations are similar to what was in the SEC cease and desist order. I learned in preparation for this argument, Your Honors, that on June 27, 2016, in that very matter involving Equity Trust Company, that there was a written decision issued by the administrative law judge of the SEC absolving Equity Trust Company of all the wrongs that were alleged in that matter. And I would like leave of the court to file a copy of this under Rule 28 following this hearing. Thank you, Your Honor.
What can you tell us about the elder claims?
The elder claims, it's clear that Ms. I agree with you, if I can read between the lines, that Ms. White was not 65 years old when she made the investment. The cases we cited are clear that the standing required by the California statute
false values and charge a fee associated with that. In 2009, Mr. Brahma became aware of this scheme, and he allowed his company to continue to send out invoices and charge fees based on a knowingly false amount. And the IRS code, and it's alleged in the complaint in paragraph 22, subparagraph E, sets forth that it's the duty on the part of the custodian to go out and seek the value. They disavow that obligation in their contract, but that can't supersede what the law or the regulations require. And then lastly, Ms. White inquired of Mr. Brahma in 2013 about why her statements still continue to reflect this amount, and he said there's nothing we can do about it. So clearly you have a situation where there is a continuing tort.
But at that point, she knows that the statements are false at that point, right?
Certainly.
How long does she know that they're false?
Arguably from 2009.
Yeah, about, in 2009 would put you 3 years before those. That's outside the statute of limitations.
Well, Your Honor, the statute of limitations is the way I view the statute of limitations in this case is they're operating under a continued. They have a custodian that sent them documents that are regulated by the IRS.
But they're not fooled by anything, are they? They're not being fooled by this.
No,
she knows that the statements are false. She's known that for quite some time.
They're just being ripped off.
Well, why didn't she file the case when she first realized that there was a problem?
Well, Your Honor, she's in contact with them in 2011 trying to get it reduced. I mean, it's not like she's sitting down doing nothing. She contacts Brahma. She contacts
Assets. It isn't a matter of all the things she did otherwise. It's a matter of if she knows of her problem and she doesn't go to court to do anything about it, she loses.
Well, not, Your Honor, not when there's a continuing tort. When there's a continuing tort, the statute of limitations renews every day the tort occurs. And I think that's the situation where you have here, and I think it's pled. The facts show it, and the law allows that type of claim to be made. I think it's time. Thank you.
These cycles have been quite a joke.